We continue the shiurim gemara. The gemara says that in ma'arava means that Eretz Yisrael. Eretz Yisrael, when a person got married, the rabbis would ask the chatan a question. Question containing three words: ratzeh or motzeh. These three words contained everything that was about the kala, about the wife the chatan was going to marry. What did they mean? There are two pesukim, two sentences in Kohelet by Shlomo HaMelech, by King Solomon. One sentence says, Matzah Isha, Matzah Tov. One who has found a wife has found Tov good. That means everything that is good. A good wife, a good life, happiness, and so on. The second pasuk says, by the same person, King Solomon, Motzei Ani Et Marmi Mavet Et Ha'isha. I find that bitterer than death is the wife. This is seeing the contradiction. Apparently, this means that there are two kinds of wives. One is good and one is bad. When we say good, we use the word matzah. You found one that is good. And let's say, I find that bitterer than death is the wife. Therefore, when they would ask the chatan, what kind of wife did you get, matzah or motzeh? Did you find a wife that is good, or did you find one that is bitterer than death, which means a very evil one? There are many interpretations for this statement. We've had a number of them before. Today we'll just point out one additional interpretation. What is the difference between these two? King Solomon is not stipulated. He just says, a wife, he found a wife, good. He finds the wife, bad. What is the difference between Isha, a wife, and Ha'isha, the wife? Why is a wife good and the wife is evil? The answer, similar to this, we find the Gemara says that a person who has sons is very fortunate. If he has daughters, and it's very bitter for him. And the wording in the Gemara is at Ashrei Mali Shebanav Zecharim, Ashrei, fortunate is he whose children are Zecharim, males, and Oiloi Lami Shebanav Likevot, woe to him whose children are female, daughters. Now, of course, that statement too could not be taken literally because we just finished writing the fact that a person must have daughters. A man has all sons. He had not fulfilled the first mitzvah in Torah. But what does that sentence mean, too? Again, there are many interpretations there. The one interpretation is simple one. The word banim has two meanings. Banim means sons, and banim means children. In other words, banim alone, ben, son, banim, children. Now, notice the difference. Ben means a son. It can mean nothing else but a son. It cannot mean a daughter, because bat is a daughter. Plural for ben is banim, sons. At the same time, the Zohar HaKadosh says, in the Zohar we find grammatical rules in Hebrew, that if you have a number of people, and they are all male, with a special word in Hebrew for all male. If they are all female, let's say good men. That's anashim tovim. Tovim is good plural. Good women is anashim tovot. Tovot is plural for female. What if you have a mixture, a group of men and women together? You want to say they are good. And then the Zohar Kadosh says that we can use the male term a plural of a mixture of men and women. We can say tovim, the male term that would mean all, men and women together. Now the same thing here, a person has sons, it's banim. What if he has sons and daughters? We use that term banim for sons and daughters. Banim means children. So, therefore, since banim could mean sons, could mean children, in this case, We read that sentence as Ashrei to the person, Bamisha Benev, his son, Azachanim, a male. Oilolani, what was they, Shebanev, the Kevot? Not that his children, Banav plural means children, but there we translate as sons. What was to him whose sons are the Kevot female? Which means that he has sons who are like daughters. They are weak. They do not study Torah the same as girls do. A son is supposed to be a son. Fulfill the duty of a male. If a man has sons who are weak in Torah and who do not act as men should, if this son is not a man, he's like a female, woe is to that person. How do you apply this here too? The Pasuk says, Matza Isha, Matza Tov. If he finds Isha means a woman. Very good. A woman, his wife is a woman. This man has the proper type of wife. Because a woman is supposed to know a place. The Torah says, V'hu yimshol bech. The husband, the man, is supposed to rule over the wife. But Matza Ani Ata Isha, the woman is not a man. Better than that. Because Ha'isha, the extra hay, become now a gematria of Ish. The word Ish is Aleph Yud Shin. That's 311. The word Isha, Aleph Shin He, 306. There's a difference of 5. You add a He to Isha, Ha Isha, you now have 311, the same gematria as Ish. So therefore, he says, bitterer than death. Because that person who has a wife who is a man, a wife who rules the house, like a wife who becomes a man of the house, that's bitterer than death. That's the difference between Isha and Ha'isha. That's why the Rizal says, very simply, that the word Isha, begimetria devash, honey. Man who has a wife, that's the wife as sweet as honey, because she's a wife. She acts like a wife should, the ruler of the house. But if he has Ha'isha, wife who wears the pants, who rules the house, who rules her husband, she's the man of the house. Woe is to him, he has no life. His life is bitterer than death. Death is better than that. That's the interpretation. That's one of the interpretations of the statement. Now the Yemeni speaks about this item called Isha Ra'ah, an evil wife. We have different statements by a number of different rabbis in the Yemeni. Now, if these statements will conflict, you'll understand there's no question. It's just that there are different rabbis making different statements, different opinions. Not that one rabbi is stating two conflicting opinions. First, Rava says that an evil wife, it is a mitzvah to divorce. A person should not be stuck with a wife that is evil. Generally, of course, evil means that she does not fulfill the commands of Torah. A wife that might mislead him in feeding him food that is questionable, not kasher, a wife that might mislead him and lie to him about purity of family life, that is a mikveh, a wife that could poison him spiritually. This wife is a mitzvah to divorce. Or a wife that makes his life so miserable physically that he cannot even perform his duties spiritually either. In that case, though the Gemara says that the first wife a person marries, according to his mazal, is so important that he retain her, keep her throughout. Still, Rava said it's a mitzvah to divorce her. Rava adds, what if a person has an evil wife, wife of this kind, and he also had a ketubah of an extremely high proportion? Ketubah means a marriage contract. What does the ketubah say? But if she becomes a widow, or she becomes divorced, she collects this ketubah, that marriage contract. And what if the price of that contract is so high that this man cannot afford it? He is in real trouble. And that's the advice to this man. Marry a second wife. Marry a second wife. Add it to this one. The second wife we know is called a tzedah. The man has two wives. One is called a tzara to the other. And that means a trouble, a pain. Because in order to pay back to sort of eke revenge from this evil wife and another wife to the home. He could not ever expect to hurt her, no matter what he says or what he does, as much as having this second wife in the home. This can create so much friction, so much jealousy on the part of his first wife, that this will repay her for all the evil she is doing him. This point, notice, is due to the fact that the Davar holds that it is permissible for a person to have more than one wife. Other rabbis dispute this. And that's why other rabbis say that there's a pasuk which says, Yirmiyahu Navi says, I will bring an evil to those Jews who commit sins, which was a warning, one that they will not be able to escape. Which one is that? As Ahmed says, this deals with, refers to an evil wife who has a very high ketubah. This is an evil of suffering that a man will have like a chain around his neck, one for which there is no escape. The Chizkiah says that there's another pasuk in Echa, which says Hashem will place a person into a position, too, where there'll be no escaping, no salvation. This, too, deals with an evil wife with a large ketubah, where he cannot afford a divorce. Then it's Israeli, so this pasuk does not refer to that. It refers to a man whose money is tied up in cash, where he has only cash and no fields, no real estate. As we had learned previously, that Torah advises every person to own real estate, because the market is dangerous. We don't feel it here, of course, but other countries where the food market is that dangerous that at times the inflation is such that food cannot be acquired, cannot be attained for money. The only ones that have food are those who have their own fear, for they grow their own crops. The person who is left with no avenue of escape is he who has all his possessions, wealth, and cash by the time when there's inflation and the cash is practically worthless. The Yemen says another pasuk, this in the Chumash, where it says that Hashem says to, again, to the Jews as a warning, I will torture you with a strange, despicable attacker. And one rabbi says this refers to an evil wife with a large ketubah. Rabbi Lazar says this refers to the tzedokim, the most evil, despicable type of person is a tzedoki, meaning a person who believes in the Torah, but only that part of the Torah which is called Torah Shebichtav, the Chumash, not the Gemara. This person is called despicable. And the Jews that have tzedokim around them, this is literally torture, because they are constantly attacked, vilified, besmirched, mocked by these tzedokim. They are comparable to common day Reform Jews. The Yemen says another pasuk where there's also this Naval, this despicable person, but who is considered despicable in the eyes of Hashem. And which person is called Naval in the eyes of Hashem? This, the Yemen says, is one who is, there is nothing more despicable before Hashem than a person, those persons who adopt the policy of nudism, a nudist colony. This is the most despicable item on the face of the earth in the eyes of Hashem. Those who go unclothed, there's nothing more despicable before Hashem, or disgraceful than that. Here, of course, we see proof as to that question, as to what merits they have, or demerits. We find here that it's not just an evil deed. It's not just despicable, but there's nothing more despicable than this in the eyes of Hashem. The Gemara says again, speaking about Yirmiyahu Navi's warning to the Jews that if they will commit sins, they are going to suffer a severe penalty. And this is one that sounds so severe it is practically impossible to believe. It had not been believed until recently in our time, days of the Nazis, we found this could be true. It could happen. The enemy says that the Jews will be killed, they will die, and they will not be buried. They'll be considered like waste on the face of the earth without any question or possibility of burial. And for this, the enemy adds that you will find they will choose death over life. They prefer death over life. So the letter asks, how is that possible? He's contradicting himself, the prophet. He says that in death they will have no burial, no peace in death. Then why should a person find that death is better than life? There is suffering after death, too, if the body is not buried. What is meant by the sentence? The letter answers, this sentence does not refer to the first sentence we spoke about. Choose death over life means advice. These are the Shaim. It is better that the Shaim will die. They should not live in this world. That means they should die while they are young, rather than live long in this world and add to the number of sins, and thereby fall deeper and deeper into Gehinnom. The second sentence refers to the Rishayim before they become that evil. For them, it is better that they die young. With this, we can understand why many times Hashem does a person a favor and takes him away from this world while he is young. Thus Hashem sees the future of this person and decides for some special merits the person has, remove him from the world, save him from a fate that is much bitterer in Gehinnom. The Gemara says that we quote from the Sefer of Den Sida. Den Sida is one of the hidden Seferim. Den Sida was one of the wise men of the past. He was the son of Yirmiyahu Hanavi. He wrote a Sefer which was not included in the Torah. A separate Sefer was not included as part of the Torah. Because it contained statements of wisdom, the Gemara very often quotes from this Sefer. According now, the Yemenah says it is written that Sefer Ben Sida, that a good wife is a gift, as a good gift to her husband. There's nothing to bring a husband more pleasure than having a good wife. And where is a good wife found? In the hands of one who fears Hashem. One who deserves a good wife, a tzaddik, has this good wife, again, if he is fortunate. Of course, there are many exceptions to this rule. An Isherah, an evil wife, is a leprosy for her husband, as though he had leprosy. It's a fatal disease. What is the cure, Ben Sida says, for this leprosy? There is a cure for it. Divorce the wife, and he tells cure to this leprosy. Now, what is the point here? Why does he compare it to leprosy? Because the Gemara says that leprosy has one good factor attached to it. One who contacts this disease of leprosy gains in that he has his sins forgiven by it. It's a suffering that erases a person's sins. Here, a person who has an evil wife has a special benefit in this case. The Gemara says one who has an evil wife does not divorce her, lives with her, that person gains tremendously. His reward is that he will never get to Gehinnom. He has suffered enough life here. He has seen his Gehinnom with this evil wife. He will never even see the entrance to Gehinnom, living it even closer to the entrance to Gehinnom. This is why the Benazal states in his Sefer Likutei Moharan, a person who has a dead wife should never complain. He should know, accept this with simcha, with happiness, because he should know this wife is rescuing him more than any other act in existence, or than any other item could save a fiyeh, an evil wife does. one who suffers with an evil wife knows that at least he is spared. He will never see Gehenna. And Sita continues, a good wife, lucky is that husband because his life is doubled. He has so much happiness that though he lived a double life, with an evil wife, his life is shortened. Remember, Sita gives this advice, very wise advice, and how wise it would be the people to stop and think about this. Think and then act upon it. The Sita says, never worry about a potential danger or loss or trouble or tragedy that may occur tomorrow. Never spend time worrying about it. Don't let it bother you, because you don't know what tomorrow will bring. It is possible two things may happen. One, tomorrow will come, and you won't even be here anymore. You might not live to see tomorrow. But what did you worry about tomorrow for if tomorrow wasn't even your world? It's not your world anymore. What could it do for you to worry? Second, it is possible you will live till tomorrow. But the item you're worried about is a certain Asher who's taunting you, tormenting you, and you're in danger. Tomorrow may come and that Asher might not be alive, or the source of that worry might disappear. So tomorrow will come and you'll find that you have spent a whole day or a whole era worrying about something that never came to pass. So why worry about the future? All you have to gain by it, the only gain is the worry itself, which could do great physical and spiritual harm to a person. A person should not worry, even in a physical sense, and certainly more so one who has the emunah bitachon in Hashem. He surely should not allow himself to worry about the future. Also, avoid allowing too many people to come to your home, taking too many people to your confidence, because you never know when one might prove to be a false friend or might betray you. Be very careful if you possess a secret. Do not reveal that secret loosely to others, because there are many loose tongues about who may promise you to keep this secret, but you'll find that their temptation is so great that it'll pass quickly from one to the other, and you'll find yourself regretting very much that you had revealed this item. Your own tongue should be kept closely guarded in your mouth. You can never draw back, bring back a word that is said. Before the word is spoken, you are the master of that word. After you have released that word from your mouth, you are no longer master over it at all. Therefore, Ben Sita says, reveal your secrets to 1 out of 1,000 people. 1 out of 1,000 good people, reveal it to that one and no more. Even it says a statement which we once spoke about before. You mentioned it before, but now the Yemeni goes on to expound on it. Mashiach will not come until all the neshamot, the unborn souls, will come down to this world. The wording in the Gemara is that Mashiach will not come till all the neshamot of Guf are finished, completed. Guf is the name of a special treasury place in heaven, the storage place in heaven, where the neshamot are kept. Until every single neshama in that place, Guf, is used up, sent down to earth. Not until that time will Mashiach come. We mentioned, of course, that Rizal said that Guf means body. Rizal interprets it as meaning that the Adam Arishon, he was created, he was so large, as Begimeta says, he cometh from one end of the world to the other, meaning that he cometh from the beginning of the world to the end. He contained within himself, within his body, he contains all the neshamot that were ever to be created. And therefore, this means that till all the neshamot of the body of Adam Arishon, when they are finished, then Mashiach will come. In any case, though, the point is that The Shia Quamet come to own the Shemots of down to earth. What is the reason? Because Hashem says, I maintain justice. Justice means that even if I know something to be certain, I don't want to have a person complaining that there was anything unjust. Now, a person who is a Shemer who is not born, if Mashiach comes before that he's not born, this the Shemer would complain and say, if I was born, I could have been a tzaddik. He could complain that. Hashem knows better. He might have been an Asher. But this person says, there's no proof. I would have been a tzaddik. Hashem says, in order to avoid any complaints like this, but every one of these Neshamot have his opportunity to be brought to earth, then there are no complaints. Then you stand trial for exactly whatever you have done and accomplished during your life. But now, the pasuk that the Gemara learns this from is the pasuk in Shayah Levi. Shayah the prophet says, Yinuach milfanei ya'atof, Hashem says that a spirit from before me, ya'atof, will be held up, will be held back, uneshamot ani asiti, because of the souls that I created. This means spirit of Mashiach will bring salvation to the Jews, will be held up. He will not come because of the neshamot that I created, until every one of these neshamot is sent down to earth. In this pasuk, Yiruach milfanei, we find that this is very amazingly fitting, because Ruach milfanei is begimetria, exactly the same as Mashiach. This shows clearly that this is Mashiach we're speaking about. The Igor HaKadosh says, Mashiach, begimetria, 358, Mem Shin Yutchet, 358. Begimetria, the same as Nachash, serpent. The Nachash, Nunchet Shin, is exactly 358 too. And the Torah Kadosh says that one is opposes the other. They're equally balanced. This is a battle until Mashiach comes. Then will this serpent, this dragon, be slain by Mashiach. Until then, there's an equal balance, the constant battle between the good and the evil forces. Power of Mashiach ben David against this Nachash. And therefore, this pasuk refers to that too. Yiruach milfanei ya'atof. The spirit before me is held up. What is holding it up? The battle between this equivalent, equal to it, which is the Nechesh. The serpent is holding up Mashiach from coming, which means the evils that are done, which delay the coming of Mashiach. And the question is, how could he delay the coming of Mashiach, if the very same pasuk says that Mashiach's coming depends upon the neshamot that are unborn? When they are completed, when they come to the world, Mashiach will come. What has this got to do with the nechesh, the serpent? The answer is that there's a pasuk which says, Ani Hashem be'ika achishena. Hashem says that there is an established set date for Mashiach to come. That's the ita. When this time comes, Mashiach will come. Achishena, but it is possible that Jews do teshubah. If they overpower the eve of the Nechesh, Achishena, I will hurry up that date and bring Mashiach before then. The question Tosafot asks is, how could Mashiach come before then if there are still the Neshamot remaining in heaven? Tosafot answers that Hashem will, at that time, perform miracles in the sense of blessings, that there'll be so many children born at one time, so many triplets, quadruplets, quintuplets, born so frequently that all the Neshamot will be used up at one time rather than have to wait for a long period of years. If the Jews do teshubah, then they will have these miracles of childbirth to a point where the Neshamot will be used up. That if the power of Gog overcomes the evil power of the serpent. But the Gemara says there's a debate about an item. Rabbi Elazar says that a person who does not care about having children, either he does not get married and therefore doesn't have children, or he gets married and refrains from having children, he abstains from it, that person is considered a murderer. The fact that he does not bring children into the world, he is considered a murderer. This we find in a pasuk. In Bereshit says that one who spills the blood of a person, that person's blood in turn will be spilled. He'll pay for it, pay the death penalty for it. The next pasuk says, and you shall be fruitful and multiply, which means there is a connection. That if you are not fruitful, if you don't have children, it is considered as though you spilled blood, as though you kill. Why? Because if you are fruitful, there is life added to the world. If not, you are depriving that life from coming to the world. There's no difference whether the life came and you killed it, or whether you stopped it from coming in the first place. That many living beings are not on this world because of you, just though you killed. Therefore, Rabbi Elazar says that one who does not have children is as though he killed, committed murder. Rabbi Yaakov says that one who does not have children, it is as though he subtracted the Shekhinah from the world. Because the Pasuk says that Hashem created Adam in the heavenly form. Formed with the Shekhinah. That means every human being, every person. The one who does not bring children to the world means that they are subtracting, there is less the form of the Shekhinah in the world. Ben Azai says, I disagree with these two, he said. In fact, I agree only with both together. I say that one who does not have children, that is, he is committing the sin of both killing, spilling blood, and subtracting from the form of the Shekhinah on earth. All the rabbis got together and they said to Ben Azai, there are some people who lecture beautifully, they preach, and they also practice what they lecture. They fulfill the lessons they give. They learn and they obey. There are some who cannot, they don't know how to lecture well, but they obey the mitzvot anyhow. But you lecture very beautifully. You spoke nicer than the other two rabbis. The lesson would fit perfectly, but you don't practice it. You don't fulfill what you said. Because Ben Azai did not have any children. That's why he was called Ben Azai, the son of Azai. His name was Rabbi Shimon Ben Azai. He was not called Rabbi Shimon due to the fact that he did not have any children, for he was not married. But for that reason, he was never allowed to be called by his own name, because he had not fulfilled the mitzvah becoming married and having children. And as I replied to them, you are right. Of course, a person must fulfill his mitzvah. But what can I do? My soul so intensely craves a study of Torah that I cannot stop for a moment in the study of Torah to take time off to have a wife and have children. I can't live for a second without Torah. Let the world continue, perpetuate through others who are not devoted to Torah as I am. Interestingly, the Rambam, the Bet Yosef, and Shulchan Aruch say, Ben Azai is right. The first mitzvah of the Torah is to have children? Fine. Anybody today who will study Torah like Ben Azai is excused. He doesn't have to get married. He doesn't have to have children. But let any person come forth and make that ridiculous statement that he is like Ben Azai, that person is a complete, unquestionable liar. There is no person today since Ben Azai who was called Shaktan. Ben Azai and Ben Zuma were called Shaktanim. Shaktanim means those who first continually immerse themselves in the study of Torah. When these two passed away, the Gemara said there were never any more Shaktanim like them, who spent their lives entirely devoted to the study of Torah. What a rabbi did spend 20 hours a day, 21 hours a day, or so on. But with such intensity as Ben Azai and Ben Zomer, the friends of Rabbi Akiva, they were also part of the four who went to heaven that time. No one could compare to them. So no one can say actually din is. Person says he's like Ben Azai, fine, he's excused. But first try to be like Ben Azai. Question, of course, in the Gemara tells us that Rabbi Akiva had a wife of unusually high quality, one who married him, knowing that she's giving up a life of wealth and luxury, just in order to have a husband who will be a chacham, tamid chacham. And she allowed him to leave home for 24 years to study Torah, come back as the leading rabbi of the world. The Gemara says there, like mother, like daughter. That's to be Akiva's wife, gave birth. She had a daughter. And she, too, desired very much to have a husband who would be a chacham. Rabbi Akiva offered his daughter in marriage to Ben Azai. Take Ben Azai as a son-in-law. And the Gemara says that Ben Azai did marry Rabbi Akiva's daughter. But why all this talk about not fulfilling the mitzvah and not being able to fulfill it because of the intense desire for the study of Torah? The answer is, Tosafot says, that we must say, we are compelled to say that one of two things happened. Either Ben Azai became engaged to the daughter of Rabbi Akiva, and he never consummated this, never got married, it was only an engagement, or that he did get married to Rabbi Akiva's daughter for the sake of the mitzvah of getting married, and then immediately divorced her. In any event, he did not have any children because, due to the fact that he said he claimed exemption on the grounds that he could not absent himself for that moment from the study of Torah. And of course, the din said that a person is forbidden to live without a wife because of evil thoughts may enter his mind. True that Torah protects a person from evil thoughts, but it is still learning Torah with an impure mind. One who wants to devote his life to Torah should first get married, the Gemara says, then sit down to study Torah in purity. Unless he is like Ben Azai, and as we said, there is no one like Ben Azai. So the advice for today is, our time, most certainly, a person must get married, must have children to fulfill the first mitzvah of Torah. The Gemara says, what happens if a person is married to a woman with the right kavanah for the sake of mitzvah tiryah v'riyah, perpetuating the race, but he finds that his wife cannot give birth? What happens then? The Gemara says, the rule is, if he's married to a woman, and for 10 years' time, she has not given birth, then he should divorce her and find a different wife. Marry a different wife because he was not so zochet to have children from this one. Or marry a second one, he will be zochet. He must have children, therefore he must divorce it. Where do we learn this rule about 10 years? Even as we learn from Avraham Avinu. Avraham Avinu was married to Sarah, and he did not divorce her. But he had a choice. He had an alternative. He could marry a second wife, if Sarah did not have any children. Pasuk says that after Avraham Avinu lived 10 years exactly in Eretz Yisrael, without children, he then took Hagar, the maid of Sarah, as a wife. From this we learn that the limit is 10 years. But we also learn that the limit is 10 years only in Eretz Yisrael. Because at that time, Abraham was married much more than 10 years to Sarah. Just that we discount completely the years they lived outside of Eretz Yisrael. There's only the years spent in Eretz Yisrael. One lived in Eretz Yisrael for 10 years' time without children, then he should divorce his wife, or, where allowed, marry another wife in order to have children. Therefore, if it is due to sickness, illness on the part of one or the other, or let's say he was in prison for a number of years, these years do not count. They are not part of the 10. If he's in prison for 3 years or so, and he's married for 10 years, he still has 3 more years to go. Only when they live together for 10 years in an Israel that the rule of divorce comes to play. Yemena asks, why don't we learn instead from Yitzhak, Yitzhak Avinu? He lived in an Israel, and the Pasuk says that he was 40 years old when he married Rivka, and he was 60 years old before his children were born, Yaakov and Esav, which shows that he lived 20 years without divorcing his wife. So why not say the limit is 20 years and not 10? Why do we learn from Abraham Avinu the law of 10 years, why not from Yitzhak, that the limit is 20 years? The Gemara answers that Yitzhak Avinu could not divorce his wife before, since she was not to blame. He, too, was sterile. He could not give birth, and therefore it would have done him no good to divorce Rivka. It wasn't her fault entirely. Now, again, Tosafot asks an interesting point. Why do we say that we should learn from Yitzhak Avinu that a person can live with his wife 20 years before divorcing her? Did Yitzhak Avinu live for 20 years with his wife before she was able to give birth and didn't? He married her at what age? She was 3 years old, Rivka, because she was born, according to the Pasuk, on the day of the Akedah, the day of the sacrifice. It says on that day, Rivka was born. Yitzhak Avinu was 37 years old on that day, which means that he married at the age of 40. She was 3 years old. And a girl cannot give birth until she's 12 and a half or 13. So the first 10 years did not count at all. It's only 10 years from there that she did not give birth. So what proof could you have for Yitzhak Avinu more than 10 years? The same 10 years. From the age of 13 and on, he spent 10 years with her. And then came the problem, the desperation point where they had to pray for children. Because of what the answer is, first place, this is a machloket, a debate, the Midrash. One says that Rivka was not 3 years old, but 14. We went through that those figures previously. That's one answer. Secondly, even if we say she was three, the Yemena states explicitly that it is only in our time that women cannot give birth till the age of 12 and a half. The olden days, women could give birth at a much earlier age, like Bathsheba, the wife of David HaMelech. There's a debate in the Gemara as to how old she was. Some say she was 8 years old. Some say she was 6 years old. So since in those days, women could give birth at an earlier age, here too, Rivka could have given birth much before 13, which proves that they waited for 20 years before they reached the point where they were desperate. Except for the fact, of course, as the Gemara answers, that Sakamina couldn't give birth anyhow. The Gemara says, we know this from the Pasuk, which says that Vayetari Yitzhak LaHashem Anochach Ishtof. Yitzhak prayed to Hashem opposite his wife for children. Does not say he prayed to Hashem for the sake of his wife, she should have children, or prayed opposite her, meaning that equal to her, both prayed for the same problem. They both were sterile. And then the Pasuk says, Ve'yater lo Hashem. Hashem answered his prayer. The question is, why his prayer? Why not their prayer? The answer is, the Gemara says, because the prayer of a tzaddik, the son of a tzaddik, is much more potent, much more powerful than the prayer of a tzaddik, the son of a rasha. Yitzchak had his zechut, plus his father's zechut, tzaddik Abraham. Rivka was a tzaddiket, on the same level as Yitzchak. But she had only her own zechut. She did not have the zechut of a father. Her father was an Hashem. That's why his zechut for tefillah was much greater than hers. That's why the Pasuk says that Hashem answered his prayer before answering hers. His prayer had priority over hers. Now, again, question here is the Bet Yosef, Shulchan Aruch, the name of the Rosh, says, when we select a chazen, to pray before the kahal, before the knees, it is best to take a chazan who was a tzaddik, but who comes from the bad stock. Not who comes from a good family, but one who did teshubah. He is a tzaddik himself, but he comes from a bad family background to show that we want to bring him close, rather than to repel this kind who have no family background. We got to bring them close to encourage them. Go be our leader in the prayers. So if the prayer of a tzaddik, the son of a tzaddik, is more effective, why should we specifically choose, select one who is a tzaddik, the son of a bad person, a shet? The answer is that this is speaking about a chazan for regular, everyday prayers. For that, everyone prays anyhow, so we bring this person closer. Where a miracle is required, as in the case of Yitzhak and Rivka, then to change nature before a miracle, you need a tremendous zechut. In that case, you have to have the zechut and mitzvah.